Follow Up North News online anytime. Search Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for Up North News WI and our homepage, upnorthnewswi.com.
As we look through the headlines every day, and this is the third hour of Up North News for this Thursday, August 25th, I'm Pat Kreitlow. Luke Mathers is here as well. Hope you're having a great day. But as we look through the news tidbits, it occurs to me, and I don't always want to dwell on the negative, but I also want to make sure that people who are doing bad or dumb things, you know, don't skate by because of our, you know, exhaustion with the news cycle at some point. And so I'm thinking we almost need to have kind of a doofus isn't the right word, like doofus of the day or some other kind of. Some kind of award that's right up there with the, you know, the fickle finger of fate from the old Laugh-In show. We got to come up with something, but I have three nominees for our as yet unnamed award.
And I just want to point out as well, I don't think you have to have the or there. Sometimes it is dumb, or I forget the two words that you use, but you said or, and I think it definitely can be and sometimes as well.
Oh yeah, there's no doubt about that. In my number three position, I would put Senator Ron Johnson, who we already talked about yesterday, as a new congressional report shows how deeply involved he was in basically trying to undermine the FDA as it was trying to save lives in the early months of the COVID pandemic and continuing to push hydroxychloroquine, one of many things like mouthwash and ivermectin and other things, quackery that Senator Johnson pushed rather than relying on science, you know, to this day, still spreading doubt about the vaccines. But in light of that congressional report, that new one, we'd put him in today's number three position. And number two would be one I overheard from you, Luke, as you were working on news headlines. And I was actually going to bring this up, the story about Harry Waite, the right-wing activist in the Racine area, who illegally obtained absentee ballots from people other than himself and videotaped it and admitted it and continues to admit it and apparently just outed himself again in his legal matters. Because I wondered if he was going to get investigated, much less charged or prosecuted. What is the latest on him?
Well, the latest is the organization that he's quote unquote an activist with, Hot Government. It's Honest, Open, and Transparent Government. They put out, not really a press release, but I don't know if it was on True Social or where they posted it. They essentially said that Harry Waite had received a subpoena from the Wisconsin Department of Justice. And it is just just asking some questions to try to get, I believe, start. But the DOJ's response was, we don't comment on any ongoing investigations. So, sorry.
So they don't comment, but Harry Waite basically confirmed.
Harry Waite's organization, Hot Government, confirmed that Harry Waite had been subpoenaed.
It's just, you know, and fine. That's what needs to happen because, again, there is no value in waiting to prosecute somebody who stands right out there on Fifth Avenue and says, I committed voter fraud as a way to somehow show that there was widespread voter fraud when there was not. What prompted me thinking about it actually was arriving at the hotel here late last night. And it's one of those that has the soap and the shampoo dispensers. They now put them in these bottles instead of the little tiny bottles. They put them in big bottles and they're kind of locked into a bracket on the wall, and then you just kind of pump out, you know, whatever you need, which is all fine. And it's kind of like the, you know, like paper towel holders and things like that, that you need kind of a special key to open it up. But it's not exactly rocket science to figure out how to open this one. In the case of this, it's just two little holes, and then you can turn it, and then you can pull the soap bottle out. So it's not impossible to steal the shampoo from the hotel, but there is a safeguard there. Because you can easily get around the safeguard doesn't mean you shouldn't put shampoo in hotel rooms. It doesn't mean that that nothing works. It means you're a thief if you're willing to go around some kind of a safeguard. And that is exactly what Harry Waite and others do. If you put in somebody else's name on the Wisconsin Elections Commission website and request a ballot for somebody.
Just imagine like being speeding, like getting pulled over for speeding and just say, no, officer, I wasn't going over the speed limit of 55 miles an hour. I was just showing you that my car could go over that limit, and you should be really careful and arrest some other people if they speed, because speeding is bad, but I wasn't speeding. I was just trying to show you that speeding could happen.
So yeah, we need I don't know if we're going to call it a doofus or what, but we need a proper title for somebody that would do something like that as well. Or somebody in today's number one position for our as yet to be named Up North News Award for Newsmaker of the Day. And that would be Florida Senator Rick Scott, who, as we've discussed before, is a bad man, responsible for the biggest Medicare fraud fine in history, yet somehow got elected Florida governor and then Florida senator. And he, or somebody really bad on his staff, tweeted out something about another week of President Biden vacationing in Delaware instead of working at the White House. Why does he love to travel so much? At the time, Senator Rick Scott was on a luxury yacht off the coast of Italy. That's as tone deaf as it gets. So congratulations, Senator Rick Scott. You are something we have not yet named yet, and maybe we'd better not. We will be back with Kiev Akil of Courier Newsroom after this. You're Up North. Welcome back. This is Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitlow, not in the Lake Wissota studio, but down at our, shall we say, our state capitol bureau for today. And we are joined by national correspondent for Courier Newsroom, Kiev Akil. But because of where he is, I'm going to say our special Los Angeles-based correspondent, Kiev Akil, with a report from Dodger Stadium, where the Brewers last night were playing the Dodgers. Because it's Dodger Stadium. Why wouldn't you do that? Kia, I'm sure you were right there in the dugout watching the slaughter. What can you tell me from the front lines right there in the infield dirt of Dodger Stadium?
Oh, man. Well, I guess I'm outing myself as not a great sports correspondent because I have no idea who won that game.
You didn't go. Here's the thing. The baseball nerd that I am, I would love to go to any stadium that I could whenever I get a chance to. So I've been to Fenway and Wrigley and some of these others, and I think Dodger Stadium would be fun. So I'm not gonna fault you for not going last night. It's the Brewers. You're more of a Phillies or what?
I am more of a Phillies fan.
But you've been to Dodger Stadium.
Oh yeah, many times.
Okay. What is it a good baseball / tourist experience, or is it? It doesn't strike me as like one of those cookie cutter baseball parks.
No, it's definitely not. It's a beautiful place, and it helps that the team has been really good for most of the past decade. But it's a great place to go watch a game. It has a great view of the skyline in LA, depending on where you're sitting, actually. Yeah, it's one of my favorite ballparks. I've been to about half of them throughout the country, and it's in my top three. The only thing that's bad is getting out of the parking lot is a nightmare.
I can only imagine. You've been to half. That's great. Lucky you, man. Well,
I've done a couple of baseball road trips with friends.
I've talked about that for forever, to do a baseball road trip, and that's. When you marry somebody that's not as much of a baseball fan, that's about as likely as my actually playing for one of these teams when we do it. You said Dodger Stadium was your top three. What were a couple of other favorites?
Yeah, so I'd go Dodgers, Camden Yards in Baltimore, and then probably Petco in San Diego. Honestly,
I've been to Petco. I loved it. It's a great place. And I've mentioned before that I was at a game. Trevor Hoffman since came to the Brewers after that, but when he was at his peak with the Padres, I went to a game one night, and boy, when he comes into Hell's Bells out of the bullpen, the crowd is, literally going wild. It just gives you chills. You picked some good ones there. Where haven't you gone that you'd like to?
Oh, where haven't I gone that I'd like to? That's a great question. I just went to Wrigley a couple months ago, so that would have been the top of the list. But mm-hmm. I've never been to Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go there at some point. Never been to Seattle Stadium. I don't remember the name at this point. I know it just changed, I think, from Safeco. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a Blue Jays game, and that's I don't really want to go to Rogers. Is that what it's called?
Rogers now, really yeah.
Care about that dome, but mm-hmm. it'd be cool to go see a game in Canada. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've been to and Luke notes that it's T-Mobile now out in Seattle. I've been to Montreal and I've taken their version of the subway past, you know, where the Expos were playing at the time, and I felt nothing but pity. I didn't get to go to a game there, but I wasn't looking to. And the only thing I think that would have been worse is the experience that I actually did have at Tropicana Field watching the Tampa Rays. Which, as I've said, that building needs to be imploded with the architects inside of it. Whoever said baseball in a tin can was a good idea.
Yeah, I've never been to the Trop. I don't imagine I'll ever go. I've seen games on TV, obviously, mm-hmm. and it looks like a hellish place to play.
it does. Again, it's like in a pinball machine. The last time the Brewers were there, like three different times they had to consult the ground rules, because if it hits one catwalk, it's a home run. If it hits another catwalk, it's a foul ball. It's just ridiculous. But this is not what we bring the national correspondent for Courier Newsroom on to talk about. But once you hear he's been to half the ballparks, how do you not? But Keogh was at Netroots Nation, a very large gathering of progressive organizers and others, which was in Pittsburgh. So not too far from some of your favorite stomping grounds. Although is that can I say that to a Philly person that you were at Pittsburgh and you were closer to home, put it that way.
I was closer to home, and I did not make it to PNC Park, but I was, you know, very close to it, which is probably my fourth favorite park.
It does look nice. Yeah. I always do appreciate that. So let's start and you know, for those of us that caught my interview with Carolyn Fiddler from there as well, we were talking about the kind of the overall tone and how it's different now because of the Dobbs decision. What would have previously probably been a convention of people going, well, the odds are against us. It's the midterms, and you can't fight, you know, the trends of history, et cetera, et cetera. It didn't really feel that way now, did it, Kia?
No, there was definitely a sense of urgency and motivation there on the ground. This was my first Netroots, so I can't compare it to any of the ones pre-pandemic, but, you know, people really, really, you know, they're fighting. They're motivated. These are like the most involved progressive activists, lawmakers, media figures. So they know, but, you know, even folks you'd see who are maybe newer to the movement are, you know, they know what's on the line. There's freedom is on the line in November. You know, fascism is not far away from happening. And, you know, most of one of the, we were talking about it afterwards, but there was a definite theme to the conference where, you know, the three sort of leading, let's say, arenas of issues that were foremost in panels and in conversations were abortion rights, labor movement, and misinformation. And so, yeah, it's post-Dobbs, there was definitely, you know, a lot of strategy and just talk about how this November is really crucial.
The messaging around abortion has changed so much since the Dobbs decision that repealed Roe v. Wade, because it's no longer theoretical. And there are countless Democratic campaigns that worked so hard not to touch what had been considered a third rail. But then mm-hmm. somebody came and, you know, used the metaphor you want, took the rail away or supercharged it, whatever the case may be. And now I would think the debate in many progressive circles is how few races there are now where that would still be your position. I mean, we just found out in that New York race that Pat Ryan won. You take that message, you make it about rights and freedoms, and you run with it. Or are there still, was the talk there that there are still corners and places where it's still too soon, it's still not right? I can't imagine there would be.
No, that definitely did not come up. There's a sense, and I should note, this is, you know, the people who are mostly in Netroots are not, you know, the Joe Manchins of the world.
Right,
but, you know, Pat Ryan is in a rural swing district in New York. Like, that is a seat that he had no business really winning, and he won. And so, yeah, I think, no, there's definitely no talk of, you know, moderating and not talking about abortion. I think that ship has sailed. And, you know, there is a handful of frontline Democrats who aren't really focusing on it in their races. You know, you have Jared Golden in Maine and a few others throughout the country, but they're in the minority. And I will see if that's a smart strategy or not. I don't, they know their districts best, arguably, but I think that special in New York, the other special elections, just the general, if you look at the polling, if you survey voters on what they think about abortion, if you look at the backlash in terms of new voter registrants are predominantly women, predominantly registering as Democrats, there's no doubt that if the landscape of abortion rights has changed. And I'm of the belief that, you know, lawmakers should have been more proactive and talked about it, you know, for years. But you can't argue that once people, a lot of times things don't click into place until you've lost something. And so obviously when, like you said, it's no longer hypothetical, it becomes real, you know, the urgency ramps up. And it is, so I think it is unquestionable that, you know, abortion bans are widely unpopular. And so we're seeing Democrats talk about that very openly and very bluntly about what's happening. And I think that's both good for them politically, but also is just true. And so, yeah, there was definitely no tiptoeing around it in Pittsburgh.
No, because the ground has shifted so much. The plates have shifted so much in a couple of different ways. One is about abortion rights, and the other is about democracy. And previously, the words that would have been thrown out on those are, it's all hypothetical and it's all hyperbolic. And you really can toss those out now, because in both cases, there have been such fundamental shifts where you say, oh, nobody would ever really overturn Roe v. Wade, and nobody ever would be against, you know, American democracy and try to overturn an election. And yet here we are. So my question is, now that these things are real, now that these conversations are being had and they are more direct, does that mean that Democrats and progressives can actually overplay that hand and somehow it comes back against them? Or is this such a swing year, such a pendulum changing year, that this is going to be, these two topics amongst others are going to be so front and center?
That's a good question. You know, I said a minute ago that I think for a long time, a lot of Democrats tiptoed around the issue of abortion. And I think and there's critiques of that. I think one of the upsides of that is because if you've approached this issue with sort of kid gloves for years, there's a lot of downsides to that. But when something like Dobbs happens, then, and we see this newer, more honest, blunt rhetoric, it's new. And so it doesn't feel like the same talking point or, you know, rhetoric that's been used for a decade. So people, I feel like, are responding to it because it's new and it's a different version of it. And so my personal opinion is, I don't know that there's a huge risk to overplaying it, because it's real, it's happening. You can't really argue it. And I'm sorry, my cat's going crazy in the background. And as for, you know, the democracy angle, like, again, it's real. They are trying to take over, you know, precinct positions and install, you know, every day there's a new horror story about the, you know, Trump MAGA movement's effort to overtake elections and just attack democracy. And that's real. That is not something, you know, there's been a long history of, you know, movements in this country to rein in voting rights and not allow some people the franchise over the course of American history. But, you know, in modern history, this is new. And so I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, you know, what they're doing is bordering on fascism. And so I think you have to be honest about that. January 6th happened. You know, people were warning that, oh, he'll cause a fuss and then he'll leave quietly. And anyone who paid attention for 4 years knew that wasn't going to happen. And so for people who are naysayers, I think just look at what's happening. Like, it's real.
I think as well, talking about the threats to democracy in that same vein is the misinformation that we've talked about previously and that you mentioned was being talked about at Netroots. So we're going to talk about that on the other side of the break. Once we take care of any concerns we have about your safety, because I really thought somebody was getting set to throw books at you. And I know the cat has no opposable thumb, but I was getting genuinely concerned. But
no, he is just he's going crazy. I'm going to put him in the other room once we get a break, because it's the moment we start. He has been calm all morning.
And oh,
the
sure.
Moment
we started, oh, please. It's, you know, I know. Parents, grandparents, all of us pet owners, we know. Kiev Akil joins us and more after the break. You're up, Norm.
Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. You're listening to Up North News.
Well, you can hear the crowd, whether they're at Petco or what was then Miller Park. The doors to the bullpen open. Out steps Trevor Hoffman. And you know the game is over. It's just over. And then, like all other relief pitchers, they eventually burn themselves out. And I hope the same thing isn't happening to Josh Hader personally. But if it happens while he's now at Petco Park with the Padres, well, that's baseball. I'm hardly one to crow, given what the Brewers have done their last couple of games. Kiev Akil, national correspondent for Up North News, joins me as we talk about the Netroots Nation conference that was held last week and other stories that he's been working on for Up North News. Before the break, we were talking about one of the main topics was misinformation and how you counter it. And it always strikes me as walking some kind of a tightrope, because you want to help somebody understand that they've been lied to or at least misinformed. Then there is that natural gag reflex. You are afraid of provoking, that they'll say, you know, are you calling me stupid or whatever? So you need to explain something in a way that doesn't hurt the other person. But then you other have people saying, no, you rip the Band-Aid off and you just, you know, go for the splash of cold water. And you know, these are real disagreements, and there's a lot of pop psychology involved in all of this, but we're all amateur psychologists at heart. So what was the discussion like there on how you tackle misinformation in an election year like this?
Yeah, I mean, there were many, many panels. Carolyn Fidler, who you mentioned, moderated one on Saturday about misinformation and the media's role in it. And, you know, and this is something one of the panelists, a point they made was, you know, there's sort of two tracks on this. One is, it is a platform problem. You know, whether it's Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, Google, all these platforms are, you know, responsible in some way. They are insisting they are not media companies, you know, that they don't have, you know, they're not trying to, you know, pick a lane or, you know, really get involved, but they are media companies. There's, I don't think, you know, maybe setting Google aside, you could make a case Google isn't, but I don't think there's any discussion. I don't know anyone in good faith who could argue Facebook is not a media company or TikTok is not a media company. It's content. It's all content. And, you know, these companies profit off ads, which are boosted by engagement and user, you know, people spending time on the platforms. And over again, we see that what drives people to stay on the platforms is conflict, is anger, is emotion. And unfortunately, a lot of that makes way for misinformation to thrive, both paid and organically. And, you know, so part of it is a platform problem where, you know, unless you really rein in Facebook in some way, whether it's breaking it up or changing the regulations, I don't know that you're swimming upstream. But in terms of what individuals can do, as you were talking about, you know, to help people who may be being affected by it, I think there's a couple things that sort of I took out of Netroots, which I'd already, you know, and new things I learned, some things I already knew. But one is, you know, until the government does something, or Facebook's never going to reform itself, but until something happens to change the business model or the way they operate, you know, you can't just cede the ground to all this nonsense. So one antidote, which is what we do at Courier, is to try to push back with good news, good information, actual factual news. And so that, you know, when people are scrolling Facebook, they don't just see 800 right-wing lies. They might see 800 right-wing lies and you know, a couple posts from CNN, a couple posts from our news outlets, and hopefully, you know, that will, you know, maybe prevent some folks from being, you know, convinced by these lies. So that's one thing. The second thing I think is who is presenting that news is really important. You know, if it's a trusted voice in your community, that matters. If it's a local news platform like, you know, Up North News, who's built a loyal audience who trusts them, that also helps.
Thank you. It's
well, no, but I mean, it's true. People trust their local news more. And, you know, that's sort of our model here at Courier is reporters on the ground in our states, and they're trying to meet people on these social platforms that are rife with misinformation to give them bits of actual news. So that's something else. But I think in terms of like pop psychology, how do you persuade someone without them, without you making them feel like they're an idiot? That's really hard because people don't like to be told they're wrong. People don't like to be made to feel stupid.
But sometimes I feel like in some of our earlier conversations, the way to do that is just to provide them with some new information rather than saying the old information is wrong. That once you can engage in a conversation, once you get, you know, somebody either reading your website, your blog, your newsletter, or watching your videos or what have you, you don't have to necessarily be confrontational. But if you're putting forward factual information that it just, you love the look where they go, oh, I never thought of it that way. And suddenly you see that, you know, light bulb start to go off. Doesn't mean you're always going to be successful, but at least engaging in that conversation, even as a media company, engaging, you know, with a viewer and a reader, yeah, you have to start somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a huge part of it. I think another part also is two things. One is there's more and more data. I think Google just published something yesterday where there's something called pre-bunking, which is, you know, debunking is you try to correct something after the fact, after a lie has already spread to 8 million people. And people tend to stick to their first impressions or the first thing they hear about something, unfortunately, a lot of the time. So pre-bunking is where you try to get ahead of it and anticipate what kind of crazy misinformation might spread and try to get ahead of it and publish factual news that pre-bunks it.
Sure. We did that in 2020, and then I'll let you get to your other point, but I wanted to make this point about it. This is something that more legacy media, mainstream media, whatever you want to call them, should be doing, and there is nothing partisan about it. Now, one outlet's headline might say, as a pre-buttal, and we did this in 2020, Donald Trump is coming to Wisconsin today. Here are the things that aren't true that he's going to say. Now, another place might take the headline that says, here are 10 lies Donald Trump's going to tell. I'm not saying your local TV affiliate has to do that, but they certainly can do that kind of a pre-buttal that Donald Trump is coming to town, and if the record holds true, he's going to talk about this and this, and you can do that. There's nothing partisan about truth.
No, and that's the problem. This leads to a whole other conversation, but that is the biggest problem in media today is we are at a point where simply telling the truth feels partisan to certain media, to certain reporters, certain media companies, because you're up against, you know, the former president and large chunks of his base, which fully live in a different reality of lies, unfortunately. And, you know, they don't believe the election was valid. They tried to overturn it. They are continuing to try to, you know, they're planning to overturn the next one. And, you know, even if that fails, like, that's just true. Like, they've admitted it time and time again. They're trying to install people in positions of power to control election offices. And so telling the truth about that is not partisan. It's pro-democracy. That's what journalists are supposed to do, is to tell the truth and hold people accountable so that we live in a democracy. We don't want to know what it's like to not live in one. Look at Russia. Look at a lot of other countries. My family's from Iran. That is not a democracy. And I know I hear what it's like to live there, and I don't want that here. So that's one thing. The other thing, which ties in about misinformation, is, you know, calling out why, like, who's benefiting from this. You know, pre-bunking is great and important. I also think when you can't do that, and, you know, there's these lies about, you know, let's use the 2020 election, for example. Who benefits from those lies? Donald Trump. That's pretty much it. And his sycophants who are in his corner. I don't actually, there's no, like, ordinary working class American that's benefiting from that lie. It's harming everyone. I would even argue the like Mitch McConnell wing of the Republican Party is not benefiting from that. I don't think it's a popular opinion. It does not really persuade swing voters. But the only person benefiting is Trump, and that's both financial and just, you know, psychological for him. He's fundraised hundreds of millions of dollars off these lies. He is now made it a litmus test, and it all leads back to him. So that's not something that's going to persuade his foremost supporters, but there are people out there who might have questions about the election because they've seen it in the headlines for so long. But if you can kind of connect those dots to, he lost, he's a president, he has an ego, he has made a lot of money from it, and he wants to clearly avoid jail time for all the things he's potentially done, maybe that can help sort of convince some people.
One last point on media as well, in this digital media age, that I want people to understand, is that while media companies like Courier Newsroom and Up North News are doing what they can to provide content that is truthful and informative and entertaining and you know, interesting, in this media ecosystem, the reader actually has a great deal of power. Part of it is not spreading things that are untrue and saying, I don't know about this, but I'll put it out there. Not getting into flame wars in the comment section, but sharing, reposting things that are truthful, that you do like. And you don't have to put a snarky comment on there or anything, but just the sharing of good information is something that should become contagious on social media and can undo at least some of the damage that's out there.
Yeah, I think that's a hugely important point. And that's something we are really trying to do here, is not just publish good information, but encourage people to share it, because it is important. And, you know, I think it's especially important, you know, I don't want to tell anyone who has a family member they've fallen out with over politics that you need to talk to that person. I don't believe that at all. But I do think if you have, you know, someone who's prone to these lies, who believes in these conspiracies, whatnot, who you are still close to and you want to try to talk to, like, I do think it's important to share good information with them and come at them in the ways we've talked about here, with, you know, giving them, you want to give them runway to walk away from all the misinformation. And I think sharing good information is helpful in that. And especially if it's from a trusted source with who they might actually respect in some way. But yeah, I think if people need to do that both in their smaller circles and just more widely. You know, we live in a fire hose of content and it's exhausting sometimes, but
oh yeah,
a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. But it is unfortunately the digital world we live in, and the right and the Trump movement are not going to stop until they have power over everything. Like, that's pretty clear, even if it means dismantling the FBI, the federal government, public schools, elections boards. They're like, they want control over everything. And, you know, it's not just about factual information and sharing it, but that is part of it. You know, we need to have a shared basis of reality if this is going to work.
It's the cat. The cat is calling from the other room. This cat is out of hand. It's just, I've left you all of about a minute to talk about student loan debt, and you just put a great article on our website, upnorthnewswi.com, about it. And I added a little bit to it about how more than something like 700,000 people in Wisconsin have student loan debt. And that collectively, just in this state alone, that's $24 billion. Now, that's not being all wiped out, not by a long shot. But the fact that some of it is going to be a real shot in the arm. I mean, people are coming at this from a lot of different ways, Kia, but the way that I think needs to be emphasized is that for a whole lot of families, this is a nice little bit of economic stimulus, properly timed.
Yeah, it's a little bit of economic stimulus. And, you know, a lot of these people have struggled to buy homes, have struggled to buy cars, have struggled to make payments on credit card bills or other debt, or start businesses because of these loans. So, and they can hang over you. And the other thing is, you know, there's a lot of criticism of, oh, people, if you take a loan, you should pay it back. But, you know, a lot of these loans have really predatory interest rates. Mm-hmm. People felt like they had to take them out because, you know, a lot of the sort of messaging in our culture was, oh, you got to go to college to get a good job. And, you know, that may or may not be true. I don't know if that's true anymore. But for a long time, you know, kids in my generation, I'm about to be 31, heard that. And so we went to college, even though the cost of college has tripled in the last 40 odd years, and the federal government's help has stayed pretty much the same. So when you hear all these lawmakers and conservative like legal minds criticize it, you know, they went to college when it was $600 a year.
Exactly. It was a lot cheaper for me as well. And so I really want people to read your article about the benefits of it. Kiev Akil, good to talk to you again. Thanks so much. All right. Have a great day. Good luck with that cat. We'll be back to wrap things up after this. You're up north. So as we wrap up our Thursday morning visit, I wanted to just finish on the student loan debt relief that was provided yesterday, where we kind of wrap things up with Kia in our last segment. And that's because there's been a lot of focus on the loans themselves and the forgiving of $10,000 or $20,000 of those loans, depending on your circumstance. But I don't think nearly enough has been said about what the effect of that actually is. And I don't want to hear about the moral hazard of, you know, somebody got a loan forgiven that somebody else didn't. This is something we see every day. Somebody got a tax cut that somebody else didn't, usually a billionaire or something like that. Decisions are made at a point in time. That's not to say there can't be something that in the future looks back and provides a tax credit for the loans that you did pay back earlier. But you have to start someplace. And as Kia was saying, some of these loans have become so predatory, these debts have become so high that there was action that needed to be taken. But again, the thing that I think is being missed in this is what it means to household economies and to local economies. My eyes were really opened up to this for a time when I was working at One Wisconsin Now, or I should say working with them, volunteering on the board of directors. And at the time, the leadership there was Scott Ross and Annalise Eicher and Mike Brown and Cody Oliphant and just some other fantastic people.
Jenny Dye.
Jenny Dye. Can't forget Jenny. Sorry, Jenny. And it was 2009-ish when they realized that for their generation, not only had higher education costs gone through the roof, but financial aid did not keep up through all kinds of fault, state legislatures, Congress, what have you. And that student loan debt was approaching $1 trillion nationwide. And now it's getting closer to $2 trillion. And as they studied it, they did various surveys and other things. What they came up with just jaw-dropping revelations of how many people weren't buying new cars. They were trying to make the old cars run as long as possible. They weren't buying new houses. They were, just paying rent because these payments were just so insane compared to when I was going to college in the early 80s. And again, a summer job could pay for that. So at One Wisconsin Now, they really focused on that issue to make clear that this is a local economic matter and that if you provide some relief, I'm not saying you have to make higher education free, though there is a case to be made, but if you provide some relief, instead of that money leaving Wisconsin to go either to the federal government or more likely to banks that are out of state that does not necessarily get reinvested here, instead of sending that money out of state, that money is going to be used at the local car dealer. That money is going to be used for a local mortgage or for appliances, or people can finally start saving for their retirement instead of falling behind and hoping Social Security doesn't die, or putting that money away for the education of their own children. Because it's not like tuition's going to go down, in the 18 years between when a baby is born today and when he or she is going to go to school. So every one of these things has been a drag on household economies and on the local economy. And so by taking the action that President Biden did yesterday through executive order, what you've really done is you have passed an economic stimulus plan, one that has direct impact. Couples know right now what they're paying per month and how much less they will pay or what is being wiped out entirely if their loan wasn't that big, and that is something they can now use to afford daycare or to finally go ahead and get a health insurance policy because now they, you know, now they can afford it on the Affordable Care Act exchange or what have you. So this to me is such a tip of the cap to Annalise and to Scott and to Jenny and to Mike and to Cody and to everybody else who showed some leadership on this issue to help focus attention on it. This day was a long time in coming, and there's still a lot more to be done. And some people don't like incrementalism, but you got to start someplace. You got to put one foot in front of the other someplace and then figure out what the next step is going to be. Is it going to be better financial aid? That's always been my case. If you want to encourage people to go to college, to tech school, to trade school, to all of those things, then provide the aid that goes along with it, because that aid comes back many times over. I got through college on Pell Grants because we're my family. But the money that was given to me has been paid back to the taxpayers exponentially in the salaries that I was able to make with my college education and make a career. And that's just one poor kid from the wrong side of the tracks. It's happened over and over again where people, you make an investment in children in some form or another. And this is just another way of investing in children. They are the children of parents who have taken out these loans. They are the children who will benefit. And by the way, it's not always children. There are so many grandparents who are among those 700,000 in Wisconsin who are carrying debt. Debt that either, you know, their child or grandchild took out that they are now responsible for. This is amazing news. And it's sad that it's been caught up in some forms of envy, or worse yet, some forms of politics, especially Republicans who are trying to make political hay out of this. And I just got three little things to say in response. PPP. Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, is one of many Republican elected office holders who took out PPP loans in the early days of the pandemic, the Payroll Protection Plan or something like that, so that they wouldn't have to lay off workers or that their workers could keep getting paid. Now, at the time, it was said that these probably aren't really loans. It probably is pandemic aid that's going to be forgiven, but it's not going to start that way. It is a loan. You are signing on the bottom line saying you're going to pay that back. And what happened? In the end, as intended, we looked at it as pandemic relief. And so Robin Voss did not pay a penny for that loan. That loan was forgiven in total, along with countless other Republicans and other critics, where PPP loan forgiveness was good enough for them. Student loan debt forgiveness, I'm sorry, I'll stop calling it student loan, education debt, because you're investing in education. That should be good enough for everybody as well. So that people can do something good with their education, better than what Luke and I have done. Luke and I have taken that investment that people made in us, and we're yapping on the radio in little broom closets tucked away in a city someplace.
I'm excited for the zucchini present that I'm expecting, though, shortly here.
See, money can only buy so much of an education. It can't buy you the ability to discern between good food and bad. But we'll continue to work on Luke daily as need be. We will, you and I, continue to invest in the education of this young man. It's going to wrap up our visit for today. We'll do it from here again tomorrow, unless Luke doesn't open the studio door this time, as he was nice enough to do today. Have a great day. We will see you on Dad Shirt Friday.